My name's Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was very afraid to believe in, that I've accessed through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, good sponsorship, and a persistent, consistent commitment to the primary purpose of helping other alcoholics, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering substance or medication since October 31st, 1978. And that is impossible for me. It would take a frickin' miracle. And that's what happened, you know, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm delighted. This is a kind of a deja vu thing or a nostalgic thing for me to be here. I was actually one of the first two people that were ever residents, and it wasn't called the Keenan House. Matter of fact, Malcolm Keenan was still alive. He was, you know, he's losing his hair from chemo at the time. There was a house, it was a Confront. It was their first house. It was, I think it was on 9th Street, but I'm not sure. It's been a lot of years. It's very early 70s. We're in the early 70s. And that was only one, that was one of 11 institutions or treatment centers that I was in. And we'll get to that. I was born with a disease that I didn't know that I had, and it almost killed me. And it's a disease that really has nothing to do with alcohol and drugs. But you don't know that if you're like me. But I can look back before I ever got high, and I got to tell you, honestly, there was something wrong with me. I mean, I don't feel like other people look. There was an awkwardness about me, an inability to connect with people the way that they seem to so easily connect with each other. And I always felt like I was coming from behind. And I was anxious about a lot of stuff. And I lived in my head a lot and had conversations with people that weren't in the room. You know, and I'm that kind of guy. And when you there's something wrong with you and you don't know what it is, but you know that you ain't right, and you're like me, what happens is I become the pretend guy. I become the guy who pretends he's not afraid. I become the guy who pretends he's tough. I become the guy who pretends like he fits. The guy who pretends like he's okay. But if you're like that and you're living the double life like that and you got the facade and you're anything like me, I walk around with this ball of squirminess inside of me. This anxiousness that maybe somebody's going to find out. And I'm always coming from behind. I must have been like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. And when I was 13, not quite 13 years old, I was hanging around with a bunch of older kids. I was living in Reading, Pennsylvania. And we pulled a burglary in the town I lived in and broke into somebody's house. And I just wanted to fit with these kids. The kids I'm hanging around with, the older kids, they're 15, 16. They're the tough kids. They're the kids that when they walk down the hall at school or down by the pool, other kids get out of their way. And when you're secretly weak and awkward and pathetic, man, if you fit with those guys, maybe some of their something will rub off on some of your nothing. Right? And so I'm trying to fit with these guys, and I'm doing anything to be accepted. And we pulled this burglary, and I go right along with it. And one of the things we stole was some bottles of whiskey out of this guy's house. And you know, looking back, I got to tell you, I didn't even know anything about it. I didn't even, you know, something that sounds so strange, but I don't even think I understood that it got you high. I'd never seen my parents drunk. I mean, I didn't know nothing about it except it was for adults, which made it a little more exciting. And I remember being with those guys, and I have that coming from behind, not quite measuring up, pretending I'm one of them thing going on. And they started passing around this quart bottle of Seagram 7. I still remember the label. And I watched. I'm a watcher. When you're not enough, you got to watch people who look like they're enough and then emulate what they do. And I noticed that when one of the guys took a real big hit off this bottle, he got a lot of attention from the other kids. So by the time it gets to me, I'm in. I'm just glad it wasn't cat urine, because I'm in. You know what I'm saying? And I took a big hit off this bottle of Seagram 7, and when the burning stopped, my God, something started to happen. And for the first time in my life, it seemed like I got free. For the first time in my life, I didn't have to pretend I was okay. It's like all those insecurities and all that crap just kind of shed off of me. And I found something that unbeknownst to me would become the center of my life. And I didn't know that. I didn't know from that moment on getting lit up would be the center of my life. If you'd asked me over the ensuing years, what's the most important thing in your life, Bob? I'd have told you a lot of stuff. I'd have told you the band I was with. I'd have told you my girlfriend. I'd have told you the job. I'd have told you school. I'd have told you the family. But if you'd have watched me, it would have become very apparent to you that the only time that Bob looks like he's okay is when he's about half lit up. And I just lived for it. When you're 15, 14, 13, 16 years old, you can't get high every day. But I'll tell you something, I got high every chance I could get. And it just seemed to move into the center of my life. Well, by the time I'm almost 16 years old, I'm standing before this Judge Hess, the juvenile court judge in Reading, for the third time. Same judge, third time. This is not good. And he's talking about locking me up at this place that had a bad reputation for abuse, and it was just a horrific place. And my mother and father are in that courtroom because my mother and father loved me. And my mother and father would have done anything to help me. I am sad to tell you that years later, I broke their heart over and over and over and over again until eventually they would have nothing to do with me. But I hadn't cut them that deep yet. And they were in that courtroom and they were trying to help me, and they made a deal with Judge Hess, and instead of having to go to this horrific place, I had to go somewhere else and live for a while. Well, I go to this new place. Now, I haven't been high for quite some time, because through the arrest and all the trouble, because I'm one of those kind of guys, I can stay sober when I'm licking my wounds. I can stay sober when I'm locked up. I can do all that stuff pretty easily. But I'll tell you something, I'm a little over ready to get high. And I get to this new place, and when you're secretly not enough, and you're like me and you're in a new place, you've got to target the guys that look like they have something going on. And I saw there was this one group of guys looked like they were pretty hip, like they had it all going on. And I'm talking to the one guy one day, and I'm telling him about me, telling him about the gang of guys I run around with, the trouble I'm in. But you know how we are. If you're secretly not enough, you can't be legit because you can't tell them the truth. You got to enhance it a little bit. You know what I mean? You got to make yourself look a little cooler, a little tougher than you really are. It's like I'm giving him the Bob story on steroids version of Bob, right? And he's listening to me, and then he says something to me that just was music to my ears. He says, "So you like to party, do you?" I said, "Yes, I do." And I thought he was going to pull out a pint because I was ready. And he doesn't pull out a pint. Instead, he says to me, he says, "Wow, you drink that liquor. That liquor make you crazy." Now, he's backing me up. Because I loved that effect. At that point in my life, I really loved that 151 rum. Oh my God, that'll get you downtown now. Whoa! I mean, just talking about it tonight kind of lights me up a little bit. But let me tell you something. If any of you guys ever drank 151 rum, there is no social drinking of 151 rum. That ain't happening. You drink it for one reason and one reason only, just a wham, get there. And he's bad rapping the thing that, man, lights me up. And then he says to me, he says, "Well, you're in trouble all the time. What if I told you that I could give you something, make you feel maybe as good as that 151 rum? Well, you then won't smell it on your breath. You won't slur your words. You won't stagger. Matter of fact, nobody will even know you're high, and you keep a whole week's supply in your shirt pocket. What would you say to that?" Well, I don't even know what he's talking about, but it's like, sign me up. And he introduced me to drugs. I got to tell you something. I'm a real alcoholic. Alcoholics should not do drugs. It's bad, man. Oh, my God. Because I do drugs alcoholically. And I'm standing in that courtroom, and if you'd asked me why I was standing before that judge for the third time, isn't it? I would have told you all kinds of stories. I'd have told you a story about snitches. I have told you a story about a society that wants to curtail real human freedom, about how they can, how you can drink in Europe. And I have told you all kinds of crap, but the real reason I'm standing there is there's something wrong with me. And I don't know what it is. But every time I go out to get high with my friends, and once I start to drink, something happens to me that doesn't happen to everybody. It only happens to people with the disease of alcoholism. And what that thing is that when the effect of the alcohol hits me and I start to feel it, I break out in an irresistible yearning to get higher. And I have had that my whole life. I have never once been at a bar or a party smoking shit, drinking for about an hour and had somebody say, "Hey, Bob, want another one?" I have never had the experience of sitting there thinking, "No, this is just right." Never, not once. So it was one more. Matter of fact, I'm the guy that if I'm still conscious, I ain't done partying. And this guy introduces me to drugs, and I'm an alcoholic. I got that allergic reaction. I got that hole inside me that nothing really fills up. And I don't know it. And in no time at all, I'm in trouble. Every drug I picked up, I just slammed it and me with it against the wall. In no time at all, I'm sticking needles in my arm. In no time at all, I'm shooting meth. But I don't shoot meth like guys that shoot meth that shoot meth. I shoot meth like a crazy person. I got guys that, like Sonny and some of these guys that have been doing it for years, are saying things to me like, "Hey kid, you better cool it." And in about maybe 8 months, less than a year, I turned myself into some kind of paranoid schizophrenic. I became the guy that if you left me alone in your car and you went in to get cigarettes, by the time you come out, I've dismantled your dashboard looking for microphones from the police. Right? Because I am nuts. I am whacked, man. I can't even hold a conversation with someone after a while. I'm so fried. I'm so spinning in my head. I'll be standing around a bunch of guys talking, and I'll blurt something into the conversation that would have been appropriate about 2 minutes ago. And I'm like, "Shh, I'm nuts." And a guy comes along and says, "Try some of this." And he hit me up with something. And when the throwing up stopped, all that spinning in my head stopped and everything in me just went, "Ah." And he introduced me to heroin. But I got the disease of alcoholism. Alcoholics shouldn't do drugs. And it's bad. And I just take it to a level just like that that surpasses. Guys are staying away from me because I'm a pig. I'm a desperado. And I started hitting treatment centers. I got on methadone and then back on heroin. And I started one of the first treatment centers I was ever in the early 70s. I was in this place for heroin addiction. Now, some people aren't going to believe this, but I swear to God, this was the truth. It sounds so bizarre today, but in the early 70s, and I worked in the field for a while. In the early 70s, if you said your problem was speed or heroin, and you did real good in group, and you beat the pillows, and you cried, and you talked about your parents, and you did all that stuff, and you made your bed and did your chores, you got weekend passes and drinking privileges. Oh, I beat some pillows in group, I'm telling you. And I got those drinking privileges. But I'm an alcoholic, man. Once I start, I can't stop. Once anything that comes, I get anything in my system that lights me up, I can't get enough. I've always been that way. And I went through a cycle of many years of drugs. And eventually, the last several years, for the most part, it was the cheapest vodka I could get my hands on, or half gallons of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And my whole life, the last few years, just came down to, it was like economy. It's let's get the most amount of, let's blot Bob out for the least amount of money. I don't care about taste. I don't care about, I'm not a specialist. I mean, I if you put me alone, and I was out here jonesing at New Tripoli on a farm with a bunch of hippies one time. I drank all their vanilla extract because there's nothing left. I mean, you know, I'm that guy. And in the last couple of years, pretty much Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, by this time, I'd been to quite a few AA meetings. I don't know what this, I didn't go to AA when I was in this place, but the place I was in after this place made me go to AA meetings. And I don't want to go to AA meetings. First of all, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't know, this is bunk. What are they sending me to AA for? And the guy who sent me to AA was a counselor who worked there. And he had seen me drink at a party. And he knew something about me I didn't know. He could see beyond the fact that I used a lot of drugs. He could see the alcoholism. He could see that I was that guy at that party where once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. He saw the physiological allergic reaction to alcohol that only occurs in people with the disease of alcoholism. I had a bunch of buddies that came back from Vietnam with mega, mega heroin addictions. You know, some of those guys to this day can have a beer occasionally, and they don't have that thing I got. But if it lights me up, it also sets in motion something that I can't get enough. And that is the definitive characteristic. Back in the early 30s, there was a psychiatrist who worked in a hospital for drug addiction and alcoholism. He spent his whole life trying to differentiate us, trying to figure, what is it? What do these guys have? One of our founders, Dr. Bob, if you were to compare usage and tonnage, did much more drugs and with much more frequency than he ever drank alcohol. Of course, if you read the big book in Dr. Bob's story, it says he did high-powered sedatives every day of his life, did barbiturates every day of his life for 17 years. That's a mega barbiturate habit. But his problem was alcoholism. And he did the barbiturates because he was just like me. Every time he drank, he'd get in so much trouble. You know? I'm that guy. The day that Bill Wilson tried to call on Dr. Bob, he couldn't see him on that day because he was taking a nap under the dining room table. You know, you got to love a guy like that. I'm that guy. I played in a band at one time, and in the band, if you were in the band, we'd play these VFW halls and places, and you got to drink free. Well, you can't do that to me. You don't put me in a bar and say drinks are on the house because I'm passed out in the booth before I get to the second. I mean, I'm that guy. I'm like that. I can't stop. If you have alcoholism like I have alcoholism and you pick up a drink of alcohol, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done. You can tell yourself all night long, me and the gorilla are just going to have a dance. No, you're not. Oh, if it was only if we could just have the dance. But there'll be blood, sweat, and tears before it's over. And it always was that way. Every time I'd start, I'd end up burning my life to the ground. And not just once or twice. Over and over. I used to say this thing to myself when I'd end up in jail or I'd end up in another hospital or detox or I'd come to somewhere and I'd be throwing my guts up and I'd be looking around and I'd be saying to myself, again? Again, Bob? You've done this to yourself again, for God's sakes? What's wrong with you? And I didn't know. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I started getting very serious about abstinence. I can't tell you how many times I would have these conversations with myself and I'd swear to myself and mean it with every fiber of my being that I'm never going to touch that stuff again. And 7 or 8 months later, I'm back at it. You do that once or twice, you're a knucklehead. You do that 10, 15 times, there's something wrong with you. And that's what I kept doing over and over again. And the last couple years, you know, I drank the cheap wine and I didn't try to get up on my feet no more. You know, I used to come off a run. I remember when I came out of this place, I went and got I went to school and took some workshops and stuff and became a NIDA certified counselor. And another time I came off a run, I went and worked at an engineering outfit. I was going to learn environmental engineering. I'd get a girlfriend, get a motorcycle, get a guitar, get the guitar out of the pawn shop. You know, I'd pull myself back up. But I'll tell you something, the last couple of years, I don't even try. You know why? Because what's the point? You build yourself up and you tear yourself down and you do that year after year. You start to get it. Why should I even try? Because I know what's going to happen. You know, all the bravado and all the, I'm going to do this. You know, that works for a few years. And after a while, if you're anything like me, it just starts to wear thin because you start getting the truth. And I started getting the truth. There's something wrong with me here and I can't stop it. And I went to psychiatrists. My parents, before they stopped helping me, used to put me on a train, send me up to New York City. My dad pulled some strings, brought me into therapy with a guy who was very famous back in those days, Albert Ellison. I'd go up there to his institute, and I was seeing a guy named Dr. Silverman for a while, who studied with Fritz Perls, and nothing ever seemed to change me. And I remember one time with Confront, we had a weekend seminar, and I did a couple of those weekend seminars where you don't even sleep, and you just deal with your feelings. Oh my God, it changed my life for 2 weeks. Right? And I'm always eventually back to being me. And back to being me sober ain't no good. And I don't know what's wrong with me, but every time I get sober, after a while, the shine of it wears off and I feel like I'm doing time. Our book, Silkworth, in the book says we become restless, irritable, and discontent. What's that mean? Well, I can't put my finger on it, but I got this inability to feel settled anywhere. I got this sense about me that wherever I am, it's not where I need to be. No, I don't know where I need to be. It's just not here. Did you ever watch a dog circle a living room looking for its spot to lay down? I'm a dog that can't find its spot. I'm irritable. I get in beefs with people. I quit jobs. I storm out of places. I go off on people. And I don't even know that I'm irritable. I don't think I'm irritable. I can't help it that I just see so clearly how stupid everybody is. You know, it's not irritable. I'm just right. I'm right about a lot of stuff. And I'm chronically malcontent. And this is the most baffling part of this disease. Because here's the kind of guy I am. I get sober and I know I ain't right. And I know there's something, it feels like there's something missing, and I can't get high. I know. Can't get high. I know that. But my God, there's something missing here. And I've got a mind that just targets stuff. All of a sudden I'll see somebody that's got a great relationship, and I'll think, oh man, I need that. If I had somebody loving me the way she's loving him, oh hey, I'd be there. And then I meet somebody like that. And what is it about me that the shine of it wears off so quickly for me? And then I just started getting disgusted with whatever it is. I remember I was in the western part of the state, and there was a steel mill there. And man, I remember thinking they paid big money. I remember they paid own a house, buy a boat kind of money. And I remember thinking, man, if I could get a job at J&L Steel running one of those cranes, man, I'd be there. And a guy through a guy and a friend, I got that job. I'll tell you, I wasn't even there 3 weeks until I realized they were taking advantage of me and they're all stupid and they don't know what the hell they're doing. You know, what is it about me? I target these things that look like, oh yeah, man, this is it. This is cool. And I bring it to me. And it's like, nah. Oh no, it's this. Our book calls that the third delusion. It says that we're victims of this delusion that we can rest, happiness and satisfaction out of this world if we only manage well. In other words, that I can get outside stuff arranged just right to make the inside stuff okay. And I got to tell you something. There is no outside treatment for an inside sickness. It doesn't happen. And some of us have paid very dearly to learn that truth. Because I bet you if this is a typical AA meeting, there's probably people in this room at one time or another had brought themselves to high levels of material stuff. But no matter how good you get it out here, if it ain't no good in here, I'm telling you, it ain't no good. Why do you think guys like me blow their brains out in $5 million homes? With everything. And I didn't know I had this inside spiritual malady called alcoholism. But there's this sickness right inside of the center of who I am. And at one time, I didn't understand what was happening to me at the end, because at one time, alcohol and combinations of alcohol and drugs was an immediate and effective and dynamic treatment for this thing inside of me that ain't right. And if you're like me, you probably had this experience where you just walk into a bar or a party and you're so locked up in your head and you got low level depression and you're spinning about stuff and you can't even talk to anybody and stay away from me, and about two double shots of tequila and you come out and play. About three or four double shots, and man, you're just rocking and roll. About five, and you start to love everybody. Remember that feeling when you're hanging with your buddies and I love you, man. Remember that feeling? That feel connected. I ran with this gang of guys. We'd get drunk, smoking reefer, doing lines, and so we'd say things to each other like, "Man, I'd die for you, man." Now, when you're secretly a lonely mope that doesn't fit anywhere, and you've got to pretend like you fit, that is amazing. That is amazing. Alcoholism is a very lonely business. And it's a disease of progressiveness. It's a progressive disease. It's a disease of diminishing returns. It breaks your heart after a while. As the years go on, none of us know why we're baffled, why we can't jumpstart the party anymore. Why all the fun just seems to be bleeding out of it. And why, frantic. If you're like me, I'm frantically trying to get back to that, the good old days when the magic was there. And when the magic was there, I'm telling you, it was there. At one time in the early days, man, getting high was amazing. I could dance. I can't dance sober. You get me about half lit up, the rhythm of the universe flows through me, man. I can play the guitar and sing better than I can play. I can shoot pool better. I mean, really, seriously, that's not delusion. I really could shoot pool better when I was about half lit up. I could talk to girls. I mean, talk to girls. Not just that awkward stuff. I could talk to girls. I remember one time I was at this dance. There was a girl there I had a crush on. And I was out in the parking lot. I couldn't talk to her. Couldn't ask her to dance. Couldn't even talk to her. I went out in the parking lot drinking some rum and coke with some guys. I came back in there and I just went right up to her and I started talking to her. And I had this out-of-body experience. It was amazing. I'm listening to myself talk to her and say these words are coming out of me and I don't know where they're coming from. And it's like I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, this could work. The words are just coming. It's like I'm channeling somebody or something. It was amazing. I get about half lit up. I could be funny. I'm not funny when I'm sober. I get about half lit up. I'm deep and philosophical. Remember those 3 o'clock in the morning smoking reefer, drinking wine, cracking the secrets of the universe. I remember saying to my buddies one night, I said, oh, this is what Buddha saw. You know what I mean? Right? And then I sober up and I'm back to being me again. And I never liked that much. I guess that's always my big secret, is I ain't no good sober. And I don't know why. And I can't change me. I've tried therapy, I've tried medication, I've tried everything. And in the progressiveness of this disease, as the years go on, the fun is bled out of it. And now I'm chasing something I can't catch. And the problems are ratcheting up continually and getting worse and worse. I mean, I started getting arrested more and more often. Not for anything with any kind of machismo. Not the kind of stuff you can tell anybody on a cell block. What are you here for?
I beat up a cop. What are you here for? I was peeing behind the building.
Right. It's kind of lame, really. I snatched some woman's old lady's purse. Pathetic stuff. I couldn't keep a job. Couldn't keep a relationship. I tell you, I did find some really sick women. And it takes a really sick, really... But you know, anybody that love a guy like me is automatically below my standards. I mean, you know how that is, right? I mean, you know, I got taste for guys, you know. And I was a blackout drinker. And blackouts became a regular part of my life. I think it was about the third treatment center, second or third treatment center I was in. A guy asked me if I ever had blackouts, and I said, I don't remember any blackouts. And he says, well, that's why they call them blackouts. But it was rare that I could remember coming home, unless I had a lot of stim. Now, that's why I loved Coke and speed, because then I wouldn't black out as much. But man, when you drink like I drink, you get blackouts a lot. And if I don't, anybody in here ever have blackouts? Just curious. Oh yeah, okay. My people. It's hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do. I mean, that's not a good deal. And if you're anything like me, I never did anything good in a blackout. Nobody ever came up to me the next day and said, oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. You peed in our kitchen. You stole my stash. You broke my lamp. You sideswiped my car. You hit on my wife. I remember the worst one. I was down in Redding and I was sick and I had the shakes. And I'm trying to get down to that state store early. They never open early. But sometimes I used to have this fantasy that if I got down there, stood in front of the big glass windows and looked pathetic enough, maybe they'd open early. They'd never open early. But I'm on my way down there to get some medicine because I'm in bad shape. And a guy corners me on the street corner and he says, do you know that you told everybody last night you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match? I just wanted to shoot myself. You know, and what happens if you're a blackout drinker, now I'm drinking to forget things I can't remember. Right? It's like a perpetual motion machine, right? And then every time I drink, I do more things that I can't stand, that I can't remember, and I got to drink to blot that out. It's a bad deal. I didn't eat much the last couple years. I ended up on the streets the last couple years because I don't really even try to get up anymore. If I was in a halfway house or wherever, and I couldn't stay sober, and I'd end up on the streets again. And I'm trying to just get enough medicine every day to keep the madness at bay. And so I don't eat because I ain't going to eat up my drinking money. I mean, if somebody give me $5 or $10, I'll go get a McDonald's and a half gallon of wine and a pack of fish. It's usually bottle to bottle. And so I don't eat. And I get these sores that don't heal right. And I'm weak all the time. And I feel pathetic. And that bile used to come up on me in the morning. And it was this, and I'd have those bad tremors. I remember, God, I was in my early 20s, and I'm in this bar, this Skid Row bar, where all the pathetic old drunks go in Reading, because they open at 7 a.m. The guys stand outside shaking, waiting to go in there. And I remember going in there, and I order a double shot of Southern Comfort, because I could keep that down pretty good. And I remember trying to drink it, and my hands are shaking, and I'm looking out of the corner of the eye, and I see the bartender. Now it's like 7 o'clock in the morning, and I see the bartender looking at me with that look of disgust and pity. I hope I never forget how humiliated I used to feel when people would see the tremors. And this isn't a party. This is pathetic. I drink and pass out and wet my pants and I walk around in it. I mean, you know, if you're 2 years old, diaper rash is cute. It's not cute in your 20s. It's pathetic. I drink and I cry. I drink and I feel sorry for myself. If you're kind enough to let me sleep on your couch at 3 o'clock in the morning when the vodka or the Richard's Wild Irish Rose runs out, I get on your telephone and I start calling ex-girlfriends. I start calling my parents and they're crying. You didn't raise me right. I'm so messed. You know, or some pathetic thing. I'll call Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll call the helpline just to have somebody to talk to, because that loneliness is on me. And I don't know what's wrong with me. But this isn't a party. And here's how alcoholism will use your own mind against you. And it'll punk you out, and it'll do it over and over and over. Unless some drastic change occurs, it'll do it until you're dead. Unfortunately, dying, drinking yourself and drugging yourself to death takes a long time. It's like being kicked to death by rabbits. It just goes on and on. That's why so many of us try to kill ourselves, because you can't hang. And I would be sober 6 months in a halfway house, and I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. I got this depression thing going on, and it's not really clinical depression. I've tried the treatment for that. It doesn't really work. It helps for a little bit. It wasn't until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978 and tried the treatment for spiritual depression that's part of alcoholism treatment, the 12 steps, that I started to get free from it. And I'm sober several months, and I'm lonely, and I don't fit anywhere, and abstinence feels like I'm doing time, and I'm hanging in, and I ain't drinking, and I'm day in and day out and week in and week out, and I'll just get it up to here with being sober. And I'm not stupid. I know that to pick up a drink or any kind of drug is to burn my life, but man, I'm having a hard time hanging here. And I just yearn for freedom. You see, when I quit drinking, I just get myself and my emotions and my anxiety and my past and my present just on me. Like that creature in that movie Alien that attaches itself to your face. I just get me right on me. How you doing, Bob? Oh, I'm hanging in there. Every time after I'm sober for a while, it feels like somebody has crimped the oxygen hose to my being. Isn't it odd when you take the first drink, what do we all do? Like somebody turned the air back on. And I got a depressed and a sick spirit. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I start to chatter in my head. And I'll start remembering the times when I was 18 years old, when I could drink a pint of whiskey with a bunch of guys, or when I could do a little bit of speed and alcohol, or when I was doing heroin, when I was doing something, and how fun it used to be and how it used to work. And I'll start imagining that it's like that again. This is insane. In the face of overwhelming experience, that the last 7 or 8 times I tried it, there ain't no party there. But my God, I want to have a party there so desperately in this condition I'm in. I want some relief from it so desperately that I start selling myself a bill of goods that there's fun in the bag in the bottle again, when in reality there hasn't been for a long time. And I was in this halfway house, and I'm sober several months, and I'm just fed up. It's not good. And I went to an old timer that used to bring meetings into the house. He was one of those AA guys. And I said to him, I was very serious. I got him aside after a meeting. I says, hey, you're sober a long time. Now that you're not drinking, what do you do for fun? And he gets a big smile on his face. He says, "Oh, we go to lots of meetings." I think, "Oh my God. Oh, I don't want to say nothing because I know how these AAs are about their meetings." I say, "Oh yeah, meetings, good meetings, yeah." But for God's sake, you got to do something else. And he said, you know what he says to me? He says, "Oh, twice a year, we have an AA dance." If you've ever gone to an AA dance with untreated alcoholism, you'll remember why I used to get high quick. Like, they put me in the van full of losers and we'd drive up to the AA dance and I'd get out of there and just trade in where everybody would look at me. And then stand in the back of the room with this, all this feeling like it's all of you having such a great time. And then there's me. Almost as if there was some sort of invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life itself. And the only thing that ever brought that barrier down was about 5 shots of tequila, half a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose, etc., etc., etc. And so I sell myself this bill of goods. Because I can't imagine, I'm the guy envisioning you. I can't imagine life without something, for God's sakes. I've tried everything. I've tried all the medications. I've tried marijuana maintenance. I've tried switching from heroin to alcohol to methadone to Dilaudids to back to alcohol. I've been down every road there is. My sponsor says that's like changing deck chairs on the Titanic. And there ain't nothing here anymore. And I go on what was to become my second to last run. I didn't know it. I got a weekend pass out of there because I'm a victim of a delusion. The delusion is that under the right set of circumstances, I can control and enjoy this. I think there's still a party there and that I can control it enough to get away with it. There'll be people in this room that'll be dead within 6 months to a year because you'll sell yourself that bill of goods and it'll punk you out enough that you'll buy it. And you'll burn your life to the ground and you won't get back. And you won't get back. And I sold myself a bill of goods and I got this weekend pass and I went to meet a guy that I'd been in detox with and I called him up on the phone and he said he had some Thai stick and he found a bar with great women and a cool band. I was over ready to have some fun. I don't want to hurt nobody. I just a weekend. That's all. Just a weekend. And I go down there and I hope I never ever forget this experience. Now it has getting high hasn't been fun for about 2 or 3 years. But I don't know it. I'm delusional. And I go into this bar with this guy and I am excited. And I've been excited for an hour or two. Like, the best part of my runs the last couple years was the hour or two before it started. I mean, it's like going to Christmas morning on your way to the tree. And I get in that bar and I'm ordering double shots, 100 proof, and beer backs because we only got a weekend. You got to get quick. You got to get there quick. And I'm throwing down this double shot, and instead of the thing happening where I get free, and so I can start shooting pool with the guys and laughing and talking to the girls and dancing, I ain't getting free. All that's happening to me is that phenomenon of craving, that thing inside me saying, "Bob, one more, one more, one more." And about on the second or third round, I'm sitting there and I'm starting to be overcome with self-pity as I watch the people in the bar that are having fun. And I look at the people laughing and carrying on and dancing with the girls and shooting pool. And I remember sitting there feeling sorry for myself and looking at them and thinking to myself, "My God, what's wrong with you, Bob?" See, I could remember when that was me. And it was like a window opened and I saw a painful, unacceptable truth that eventually would drive me to try to take my own life. And the painful, unacceptable truth was, "Bob, this depressing, pathetic reaction to getting highs is as good as it gets for you now. And you'll never, ever be able to roll it back to the good old days when you were 18 years old." And I felt like somebody had gut shot me. Because if that's true, what's the point of going on? And I never made it back off that pass. I ended up in a county jail. facing 2 years in a state penitentiary. I couldn't get out on bail. Bail bondsmen want you to have like an address and a job and stuff. And so I signed up on a piece of paper to go to an AA meeting in the county jail in Beaver County. And I didn't sign up to go to the AA meeting for recovery. You got to understand something. I have given up on Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought you were very nice people, but I knew something. I knew you had nothing for me, really. Because I'd watched you now for about 6 years. And I listened to you for about 6 years. And I knew that I am not like you because you guys, you get sober and you're magnificent. You're happy, joyous, and free. I get sober, I feel like I'm doing time. And I don't know what's wrong with me. The therapist can't seem to nail it. They keep saying, oh, it's this or it's this. And they never really nail it. And so I go to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for cigarettes, that's all. I go for cigarettes because I knew the people in AA would have tailor-made cigarettes. And I'm standing in this room waiting for the do-gooders from AA. You know, every institution I was ever in, the people from AA would show up. I'm not alcoholic, but when I end up, every time I get high, I end up where all the alcoholics are at. I don't know what that's about. And here they come. And leading the pack is a guy named Woody. And I knew Woody from Pittsburgh and Aliquippa. And I knew Woody from two different treatment centers I was in. He used to bring meetings in there. He brought a meeting into the detox I was in. I don't like Woody. Woody's one of those creepy AA do-gooders. Carries a book under his arm. You know those guys? Preachy, happy and sober at the same time. That's creepy to me. He's grateful for everything, loves everybody. Always talking about this AA and God and all that. God, creepy guy. But Woody had a lot of money. Woody drove a brand new Cadillac. Woody had a big job at the steel mill. The boss. And Woody's always there to try to, he's always saying how he wants to help you. Well, I explained it to him that I needed him to put his house up so I can get out on bail. Now, these people in AA are hypocrites. They say they want to help you until you explain it to them. He don't want to put his house up. He wants to give me a book and help me with some stairs or something. I don't want no book. I want out of here. And I got pissed at him. And I went into my act of bravado, you know, the guys like me that always do, you know, the phony crap. About how I don't need your help, I'm going to beat this thing, I'm going to get some of that Voc Rehab money. Voc Rehab money was big back in those days. I'm going to go to school. I might be a lawyer or a doctor. And Woody starts laughing at me. Now, where's the AA love? He starts laughing at me. And he says to me, he says, kid, you're not going to do any of that. He says, kid, you're probably going to drink yourself to death because you haven't hit a bottom. You haven't surrendered. Now, I didn't say nothing to him, but I was pissed. And did you ever just go, I went and sat in that meeting. Did you ever sit in a meeting? Did you ever just think at someone? I ain't saying nothing, but I'm just sitting there thinking at him, right? And what I'm thinking at him is stuff like, how dare you say that to me? You with your Cadillac and your big house. You don't know nothing about me. Haven't hit a bottom. My God, there's nothing left of me. When they gave me a phone call, there's nobody to call. Nobody. I'm totally alone here. I have tried everything now for all these years to straighten myself out. Nothing works. Surrender. Haven't surrendered. What the hell are you talking about? Surrender what? There's nothing left of me, for God's sake. A couple years ago, I had a nice guitar, I had a girlfriend, I had a good job at one time, I had a motorcycle. I think there was even a time back there where I had some self-respect. But I don't have any of that anymore. I hate myself. And I don't know what he's talking about. I do today. There's only one thing. One thing that you have to give up. Some people give it up before they ever go to jail. Some people give it up before they ever lose anything. And then other guys can never give it up. And they will go all the way down to living in the streets and they'll drink until they pass out. Maybe somebody will beat them to death like they did to one of my friends. And taped a urine-soaked rag into his, duct taped it in his mouth and tied his hands and feet together and then beat him with pipes and dragged him behind a pickup truck to, there's no skin left on him. Or some guys like me, we pass out, we throw up in our sleep, and we drown in our own vomit. Or some of us take our own lives because we can't do this anymore. And I didn't know what the one thing was. And you know what it is? You know that thing in here that tells you how stupid everybody is? You know that thing in there that knows everything? You know that thing in there that makes you the guy that fits the adage, oh, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell them much? The thing that makes you unsponsorable because nobody's telling, I'm running my ship. What he saw when he looked at me, he saw a guy, as I've seen for 31 and a half years, at a Skid Row detox in a jail that I go to. I see it every week. What he saw in me, a guy who burnt his life to the ground, who was dying of alcoholism. And in spite of that pathetic condition, insisted on being at the helm of his own ship, in spite of a painful, consistent reality that he kept running that ship into the rocks over and over and over again. I went on this, this judge cut me a break, gave me a stayed commitment, put me in a place called the Ark House, and my last place. I couldn't stay sober, and I started drinking. And I got kicked out of there, and I'm living in the park, and I come to one morning, and I'm sick, and I'm fed up, and I can't do this anymore. A doctor had told me in a hospital that year, because I was in my 20s, and I worked out during periods of abstinence, and I was physically okay, even though I did deteriorate myself time and time again. He said something that should have been good news. He says, you're young enough, kid, and physically fit enough that you could go on like this for another 5 years or more before it actually killed you. And I came to that morning in the park and I thought, 5 more years of this? I ain't doing 5 more weeks of this. And I went and got a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose and I went to a bridge down in Pittsburgh because I'm going to make this stop. And something saved my life that day. And it was not anything I would have ever imagined. It wasn't a guy from AA, it was nothing. What saved my life that day was something inside of me that I despised. And I kept it secret and I hid it from everybody. The one thing that I loathed the most about me saved my life. And what that is that secretly, all my life I've been afraid. I covered it up with violence and bravado. I was the kind of guy, I remember on several occasions, I would get in fights with guys that I knew were going to beat me to a pulp, but I'd rather have the beating than admit to myself or anybody how scared I really am. And that fear saved my life that day. I believe, with my experience and with what I knew, a legitimately courageous person would have killed himself and been glad to do it, just to make it stop. But it saved my life. And unbeknownst to me, I would end up in a hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada. I wasn't trying to go to Las Vegas. I was trying to go to California because I thought I could survive another winter on the streets if I could get out of the Northeast. It's tough being on the streets of this part of the country in the wintertime. When you try to sleep in gas station bathrooms and hallways and apartments, and people are always rousing you out of there, and they always call you names, and it's a bad deal. So I thought if I could get to California, maybe I wouldn't have to go to prison. I knew I'd have warrants out because I didn't do what the judge told me to do. And I ended up in this hospital. The Buddhists say that when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And I went to, after they took about 3 weeks to clean me up and get me physically stable, they let me go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in there. And I remember like it was yesterday, a guy named Dick Toussaint, who's now, I just had lunch with him a couple days ago, he's coming up on 47 years, and several other men who have passed away with long-term sobriety used to bring meetings into that place. I didn't know that they were the cream of the crop. the people who believed in the primary purpose, that it lived a life of abundance and tried to give it away for free and for fun as a way of life. I didn't know that that was the best AA had to offer. And it was. And I got this guy to be my sponsor, and I remember sitting in that meeting like it was yesterday. Now, you got to understand, by this time I'd probably been to 200 AA meetings in various institutions. But I could never hear you. I got too much of me between me and you. There was a great psychiatrist that worked for years with alcoholics and drug addicts, and he said something that was very profound. He said the reason that most of us will never get better, even though we may get periods of abstinence, we don't really get better, is that our egos are so sick that guys like me have an inability to listen to anybody to hear anything new. I can only listen to see how I'm already right. And if you're like that, it makes you a closed system. So you only agree with the people. There's nothing new coming in here. And I was right about everything. And in 1978, I came off that run, and I had enough of me kicked out of me that I could hear you. I remember like yesterday, I was sitting there, and these guys are sharing their experience. They're not trying to tell me nothing. They're sharing their experience. And I'm sitting there, and I'm nodding my head, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I felt like that. That guy's telling a story about trying to kill himself. I had a very similar thing. I know exactly how he felt. I failed like they failed. I thought some of the crazy stuff they're talking about. And I started to make that precious connection, that rope that eventually would bring me out of the abyss. And I got this guy to be my sponsor, and I told him I would do anything he asked me to do. And I'll tell you something, don't say that to an old timer in AA unless you mean it. Because they got lists of stuff to do. And one of the first things they started me on these amends stuff right away, which I don't like the amends. First of all, I'm working at a job for $3 and something an hour, minimum wage, and they want me to send money to people that didn't need it as much as I did. I said to my sponsor after a while, I send making these payments, I said, I don't have anything. I can't even make it paycheck to paycheck. I'm tired of paying all these people. You know what he says to me? He says, you know, they don't really want your money. Oh, good. He says, they want their money back. I thought, ah. They wanted me to go on 12-step calls. I was 2 months sober, and they had me signed up to go into the state prison. I just started a meeting. They couldn't even do that today. Today you have to be 2 years. They had me signed up. They had me taking meetings back into the detox I was in, into the Salvation Army. And I don't want to do it. They had me on the 12-step list to go out with these old-timers on 12-step. I told them, I said, I'm not ready for this. I said, listen, don't you think I should work on me first? And he says to me, work on you? You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. And he was right, man. That's all I had done for years was just think about me, worry about me, try to fix me. The book talks about this delusion. We can arrest happiness and satisfaction in this world by managing well. You know why it's a delusion? For God's sakes, there's not a demographic on the planet that's ever spent more money, more time, or more obsessive focus and energy on making themselves happy and satisfied as we have. And the end result is some of us are thinking about often ourselves. Absolute failure at managing in here, my real life, sober. And I didn't know that they were leading me into this life of self-abandonment and service. They were going to help me in this process of clearing up the wreckage of my past. They made me face the courts in Pennsylvania. I didn't want to do it. I knew they were going to lock me up, and I was surprised at what happened. They walked me through it. Which several years later, if I hadn't done it, I would have had a felony conviction. And several years later, I stood before the Nevada Gaming Control Board to get gaming licenses for gaming establishments in Las Vegas. And as I stood there, I was almost brought to tears because I realized what Alcoholics Anonymous had done in my life, in spite of me. In spite of me. Years ago, I was up in Northern. I'll tell you two little things and I'll shut up and this won't be long. Last year, a year ago in June, I got to go to Russia. AA was, it was 20, they were sell, it was 20 years old in Russia last year, so it's 21 years old now. I don't know of a country in the world that's had a worse alcoholism problem than Russia. Do you know that we live in a very, very small window of opportunity here? You know, in the course of thousands and thousands of years, 75 years is nothing. And it has only been in the last 75 years that there's been a way to go for people like me. Most guys like me throughout history have taken their own lives, or have been beat to death, or have been locked up in institutions and never got free. I have a book at home called The Slaying of the Dragon, and it's a book about the history of alcoholism and drug addiction treatment. And you wouldn't believe some of the stuff they've done to us over the years. It wasn't that long ago they used to drill holes in our skulls to let demons out. I was over in England and also in Bermuda, and in the town squares they still have historically the old preserved stocks where they put your head, if you're a public drunk and you couldn't sober up and straighten out, they put your head in this thing, lock you in there, and then people used to keep under their beds these things called pee pots where, because they didn't have indoor plumbing, and they bring out their pee pots and empty them on your face, thinking that it was going to disgust you and shame you into abstinence. It wasn't that long ago that they were giving guys like me full frontal lobotomies. If you ever watched the movie Francis, the true story of Francis Farmer, they were doing crazy stuff. It wasn't very long ago. Matter of fact, they still do it in some parts of the country. They give guys like me shock treatments. When I was over in Russia, I saw something with my own eyes that was astounding. The Soviets had done all kinds of things to try to combat this problem of alcoholism. They had their problem with alcoholism was as severe as China's problem with opium when Mao took over. They rendered the whole society dysfunctional. And so the Russians tried everything. I bet back posters, they had big rallies, kind of like Amway stuff, trying to psych people into not drinking. Crazy stuff. And one of the last-ditch efforts before this collapse of the Soviet Union, their scientists developed a chip. And they would implant this chip, if you were a chronic alcoholic, they'd give you a chance or two. And if you didn't stay sober, they'd implant this chip in the muscle tissue in your back. And if you drank, it would detect it. And I think it was also geared for certain drugs also. And it would detect it, and it would release a toxic poison that would kill you very painfully over a two-day period. I was in an AA meeting, and an interpreter came up to me. We had to talk through these interpreters. And this guy says, this guy wants to talk to you and show you something. And this man came up, and he pulled his shirt up, and he showed me this scar on his back when after about 10 months or so, or after a long period of tedious, depressing abstinence, he talked his friend into taking a kitchen knife and cutting the chip out so he could go get some relief. Now, you think that's bizarre? I bet you there's people in this room that have done crazier stuff, that have played the game of let's bet your life, hoping to get some relief from you. And that's what alcoholism does to guys like me. Without Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps and this altruistic movement, guys, I would kill myself. Years ago, probably 20 years now, I'm going back there next year, I was up on the Northern California coast at an AA weekend. And it's where the Oregon border is, and it's an amazing part of the country if you've ever been up there. And I had a day to kill with nothing to do, and this guy says, come on, I'm going to show you around. And he sticks me in his truck and he drives me out to this forest that blew my mind. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. They had trees that were 25 feet in diameter. Some of these trees 250 feet high. And we stayed there for 20, 30 minutes. It was very cool. And then he says, come on, we're going to go down. We've got a ways to drive. We're going to drive down to the coast and look at these cliffs and some rocks, things and stuff. So we get in his truck and we're driving along. And we're passing these meadows and fields. And he says to me, he says, do you notice how you don't see a 250-foot tree all by itself in a field. I said, yeah. He says, you know why that is? I said, no, I don't. Why is that? He says, well, in God's plan, God has designed these trees in such a manner that they cannot help but aspire to grow to such magnificent heights that alone their roots capacity does not support them. And they will literally grow into a state where they will topple over and die on their own aspired magnificence. What must happen is they must grow up in community, and they will literally intertwine their roots into a net below the floor of the forest, and this will feed them and support them and hold them up, and it allows them to grow into their nature. When he was telling me that, I thought to myself, that is exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life, and I didn't know that it was going to do that. Is that when I came to you and I got the sponsor and I started to work the steps and I started to sponsor other guys and do service and do actions that were contrary to everything I wanted to do and everything I felt and everything I thought was a good idea. But my God, look what all the things I thought were a good idea had done to me. And when I started to do that, I would intertwine the very roots of my life with yours. And you would allow me to grow into my inheritance, which has been God's plan for me all along. I have a tremendous, tremendous life today. I was able to retire very wealthy and very young. I don't have to work the rest of my life. My daughter will never have to work. I get to play music and record albums and write TV shows and tour around the world and pretty much do whatever I want to do. But my life is centered here and tied here. Every day, I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if a day comes up and I can't get to one, you can bet I've gone to two some other day that week. I still average 8 to 10 meetings a week. And I do that whether I'm in Kiev, whether I'm in London, whether I'm in Scotland, whether I'm in Thailand, Chiang Mai. I do AA is the center of my life. And from it, I'm rewarded a tremendous life because you've kept the idiot out of the driver's seat in my life for 31 and a half years. I have a great life. And if you're new, please hear this. It's not my fault. I am a byproduct of the power that flows through AA. A power and a grace that I don't deserve. But if it's available to me, I'm telling you, no matter how far down the scale you've gone, it's available to you. Thank you for listening.